In place of walls, some palaces were surrounded by thorny hedges. None of them are alike, she said. Your brother had part of the truth, Sir Jorah admitted. The Dothraki do not build. 1,000 years ago, to make a house, they would dig a hole in the earth and cover it with a woven grass roof. The buildings, you see, were made by slaves brought here from lands they've plundered, and they built each after the fashion of their own peoples. Most of the halls, even the larger, seemed deserted. Where are the people who live here? Danny asked. The bazaar had been full of running children and men shouting, but elsewhere she had seen only a few eunuchs going about their business. Only the crones of the Dushkaleen dwell permanently in the sacred city, them and their slaves and servants, Sir Jorah replied. Yet Vaes Dothrak is large enough to house every man of every Khalasar, should all the Khals return to the mother at once. The crones have prophesied that one day that will come to pass, so Vaes Dothrak must be ready to embrace all its children. Khal Drogo finally called a halt near the Eastern Market, where the caravans from Yi-Ti and Ashayi and the Shadowlands came to trade, with the Mother of Mountains looming overhead. Danny smiled as she recalled Magister Illyrio's slave girl and her talk of a palace with 200 rooms and doors of solid silver. The palace was a cavernous wooden feasting hall, its rough-hewn timbered walls rising 40 feet, its roof sewn silk, a vast billowing tent that could be raised to keep out the rare rains or lowered to admit the endless sky. Around the hall were broad grassy horse yards fenced with high hedges, fire pits, and hundreds of round earthen houses that bulged from the ground like miniature hills covered with grass. A small army of slaves had gone ahead to prepare for Khal Drogo's arrival. As each rider swung down from his saddle, he unbelted his arak and handed it to a waiting slave, and any other weapon he carried as well. Even Khal Drogo himself was not exempt. Sir Jorah had explained that it was forbidden to carry a blade in Vaes Dothrak or to shed a free man's blood. Even warring Khalasars put aside their feuds and shared meat and mead together when they were in sight of the Mother of Mountains. In this place, the crones of the Dushkaleen had decreed all Dothraki were one blood, one Khalasar, one herd. Kohalo came to Danny as Iri and Jiqui were helping her down off her silver. He was the oldest of Drogo's three blood riders, a squat, bald man with a crooked nose and a mouth full of broken teeth, shattered by a mace 20 years before when he saved the young Kalakar from sellswords who hoped to sell him to his father's enemies. His life had been bound to Drogo's the day her lord husband was born. Every Khal had his blood riders. At first Danny had thought of them as a kind of Dothraki Kingsguard, sworn to protect their lord, but he went further than that. Jiqui had taught her that a blood rider was more than a guard. They were the Khal's brothers, his shadows, his fiercest friends. Blood of my blood, Drogo called them, and so it was. They shared a single life. The ancient traditions of the horse lords demanded that when the Khal died, his blood riders died with him, to ride at his side in the nightlands. If the Khal died at the hands of some enemy, they lived only long enough to avenge him, and then followed him joyfully into the grave. In some Khalasars, Jiqui said, the blood riders shared the Khal's wine, his tent, and even his wives, though never his horses. A man's mount was his own. Daenerys was glad that Khal Drogo did not hold to those ancient ways. She should not have liked being shared. And while old Kahalo treated her kindly enough, the others frightened her. Hago, huge and silent, often glowered as if he had forgotten who she was. And Cutho had cruel eyes and quick hands that liked to hurt. He left bruises on Doria's soft white skin whenever he touched her, and sometimes made Iris sob in the night. Even his horses seemed to fear him. Yet they were bound to Drogo for life and death, so Daenerys had no choice but to accept them. And sometimes she found herself wishing her father had been protected by such men. In the songs, the white knights of the Kingsguard were ever noble, valiant, and true. And yet, King Aerys had been murdered by one of them, the handsome boy they now call the Kingslayer, and a second, Sir Barristan the Bold, had gone over to the usurper. She wondered if all men were as false in the Seven Kingdoms. When her son sat the Iron Throne, she would see that he had blood riders of his own to protect him against treachery in his king's guard. "Khaleesi," Kaholo said to her in Dothraki, "Drogo, who is blood of my blood, commands me to tell you that he must ascend the Mother of Mountains this night to sacrifice to the gods for his safe return." Only men were allowed to set foot on the Mother, Dany knew. The Carl's blood riders would go with him and return at dawn. "Tell my sun and stars that I dream of him and wait anxious for his return," she replied, thankful. Dany tired more easily as the child grew within her. In truth, a night of rest would be most welcome. Her pregnancy only seemed to have inflamed Drogo's desire for her, and of late his embraces left her exhausted. Doria led her to the hollow hill that had been prepared for her and her Carl. It was cool and dim within, like a tent made of earth. "Jiqui, a bath, please," she commanded, to wash the dust of travel from her skin and soak her weary bones. It was pleasant to know they would linger here for a while, that she would not need to climb back on her silver on the morrow. The water was scalding hot, as she liked it. "I will give my brother his gifts tonight," she decided as Jiqui was washing her hair. "He should look a king in the sacred city. Doria, run and find him and invite him to sup with me." Viserys was nicer to the Lycian girl than to her Dothraki handmaids, perhaps because Magister Illyrio had let him bet her back in Pentos. "Iri, go to the bazaar and buy fruit and meat, anything but horseflesh." "Horse is best," Iri said. "Horse makes man strong. Viserys hates horse meat. As you say, Khaleesi." She brought back a haunch of goat and a basket of fruits and vegetables. Jiqui roasted the meat with sweet grass and fire pods, basting it with honey as it cooked. And there were melons and pomegranates and plums and some queer eastern fruit Dany did not know. While her handmaids prepared the meal, Dany laid out the clothing she had had made to her brother's measure, a tunic and leggings of crisp white linen, leather sandals that laced up to the knee, a bronze medallion belt, a leather vest painted with fire-breathing dragons. The Dothraki would respect him more if he looked less like a beggar, she hoped, and perhaps he would forgive her for shaming him that day in the grass. He was still her king, after all, and her brother. They were both blood of the dragon. She was arranging the last of his gifts, a sand-silk cloak, green as grass, with a pale grey border that would bring out the silver in his hair, when Viserys arrived, dragging Doria by the arm. Her eye was red where he'd hit her. "How dare you send this whore to give me commands?" he said. He shoved the handmaid roughly to the carpet. The anger took Dany utterly by surprise. "I only wanted... Doria, what did you say?" "Khaleesi, pardons, forgive me. I went to him as you bid, and told him you commanded him to join you for supper." "No one commands a dragon," Viserys snarled. "I am your king. I should have sent you back her head." The Lycine girl quailed, but Dany calmed her with a touch. "Don't be afraid. He won't hurt you." "Sweet brother, please forgive her. The girl misspoke herself. I told her to ask you to sup with me, if it pleases your grace." She took him by the hand and drew him across the room. "Look, these are for you." Viserys frowned suspiciously. "What is all this?" "New raiment. I had it made for you." Danny smiled shyly. He looked at her and sneered. "Dothraki rags! Do you presume to dress me now?" "Please, you'll be cooler and more comfortable. And I thought, maybe if you dress like them, the Dothraki." Danny did not know how to say it without waking his dragon. "Next, you'll want to braid my hair." "I'd never..." Why was he always so cruel? She had only wanted to help. "You have no right to a braid. You have won no victories yet." It was the wrong thing to say. Fury shone from his lilac eyes, yet he dare not strike her, not with a handmaid watching and the warriors of her cars outside. Viserys picked up the cloak and sniffed at it. "This stinks of manure. Perhaps I shall use it as a horse blanket." "I had Doria sew it specially for you," she told him, wounded. "These are garments fit for a carl." "I am the Lord of the Seven Kingdoms, not some grass-stained savage with bells in his hair." Viserys spat back at her. He grabbed her arm. "You forget yourself, slut. Do you think that big belly will protect you if you wake the dragon?" His fingers dug into her arm painfully, and for an instant Danny felt like a child again, quailing in the face of his rage. She reached out with her other hand and grabbed the first thing she touched, the belt she hoped to give him, a heavy chain of ornate bronze medallions. She swung it with all her strength. It caught him full in the face. Viserys let go of her. Blood ran down his cheek where the edge of one of the medallions had sliced it open. "You are the one who forgets himself," Danny said to him. "Didn't you learn anything that day in the grass? Leave me now, before I summon my cars to drag you out, and pray that Khal Drogo does not hear of this, or he will cut open your belly and feed you your own entrails." Viserys scrambled back to his feet. "When I come into my kingdom, you will rue this day, slut." He walked off, holding his torn face, leaving her gifts behind him. Drops of his blood had spattered the beautiful sand-silk cloak. Danny clutched the soft cloth to her cheek and sat cross-legged on her sleeping mats. "Your supper is ready, Khaleesi," Jiqui announced. "I'm not hungry," Danny said sadly. She was suddenly very tired. "Share the food among yourselves and send some to Ser Jorah, if you would." After a moment she added, "Please bring me one of the dragon's eggs." Eire fetched the egg with a deep green shell, bronze flecks shining amid its scales as she turned it in her small hands. Danny curled up on her side, pulling the sand-silk cloak across her and cradling the egg in the hollow between her swollen belly and small, tender breasts. She liked to hold them. They were so beautiful, and sometimes just being close to them made her feel stronger, braver, as if somehow she were drawing strength from the stone dragons locked inside. She was lying there, holding the egg, when she felt the child move within her, as if he were reaching out, brother to brother, blood to blood. "You are the dragon," Danny whispered to him, "the true dragon. I know it. I know it." And she smiled and went to sleep, dreaming of home. Bran. A light snow was falling. Bran could feel the flakes on his face melting as they touched his skin like the gentlest of rains. He sat straight atop his horse, watching as the iron portcullis was winched upward. Try as he might to keep calm, his heart was fluttering in his chest. "Are you ready?" Rob asked. Bran nodded, trying not to let his fear show. He had not been outside Winterfell since his fall, but he was determined to ride out as proud as any knight. "Let's ride, then." Rob put his heels into his big grey and white gelding, and the horse walked onto the portcullis. "Go," Bran whispered to his own horse. He touched her neck lightly, and the small chestnut filly started forward. Bran had named her Dancer. She was 2 years old, and Joseph had said she was smarter than any horse had a right to be. They had trained her special to respond to rein and voice and touch. Up to now, Bran had only ridden her around the yard. At first, Joseph or Hodor would lead her, while Bran sat strapped to her back in the oversized saddle the imp had drawn up for him. But for the past fortnight, he had been riding her on his own, trotting her round and round and growing bolder with every circuit. They passed beneath the gatehouse, over the drawbridge, through the outer walls. Summer and Grey Wind came loping beside them, sniffing at the wind. Close behind came Theon Greyjoy, with his longbow and a quiver of broadheads. He had a mind to take a deer, he had told them. He was followed by four guardsmen in mail shirts and coifs, and Joseph, a stick-thin stableman, whom Rob had named Master of Horse while Holland was away. Maester Lewin brought up the rear, riding on a donkey. Bran would have liked it better if he and Rob had gone off alone, just the two of them, but Hal Mullen would not hear of it, and Maester Lewin backed him. If Bran fell off his horse or injured himself, the maester was determined to be with him. Beyond the castle lay the market square, its wooden stalls deserted now. They rode down the muddy streets of the village, past rows of small, neat houses of log and undressed stone. Less than one in five were occupied, thin tendrils of wood smoke curling up from their chimneys. The rest would fill up one by one as it grew colder. When the snow fell and the ice winds howled down out of the north, old Nan said, farmers left their frozen fields and distant holdfasts, loaded up their wagons, and then the winter town came alive. Bran had never seen it happen, but Maester Lewin said the day was looming closer. The end of the long summer was near at hand. Winter is coming. A few villagers eyed the dire wolves anxiously as the riders went past, and one man dropped the wood he was carrying as he shrank away in fear, but most of the town folk had grown used to the sight. They bent the knee when they saw the boys, and Rob greeted each of them with a lordly nod. With his legs unable to grip, the swaying motion of the horse made Bran feel unsteady at first, but the huge saddle, with its thick horn and high back, cradled him comfortably, and the straps around his chest and thighs would not allow him to fall. After a time, the rhythm began to feel almost natural. His anxiety faded, and a tremulous smile crept across his face. Two serving wenches stood beneath the sign of the Smoking Log, the local alehouse. When Theon Greyjoy called out to them, the younger girl turned red and covered her face. Theon spurred his mount to move up beside Rob. "Sweet Kyra," he said with a laugh. "She squirms like a weasel in bed. But say a word to her on the street and she blushes pink as a maid. Did I ever tell you about the night that she and Besser—" "Not where my brother can hear, Theon," Rob warned him with a glance at Bran. Bran looked away and pretended not to have heard, but he could feel Greyjoy's eyes on him. No doubt he was smiling. He smiled a lot, as if the world were a secret joke that only he was clever enough to understand. Rob seemed to admire Theon and enjoyed his company, but Bran had never warmed to his father's ward. Rob rode closer. "You're doing well, Bran." "I want to go faster," Bran said. Rob smiled. "As you will." He sent his gelding into a trot. The wolves raced after him. Bran snapped the reins sharply, and Dancer picked up her pace. He heard a shout from Theon Greyjoy and the hoofbeats of the other horses behind him. Bran's cloak billowed out, rippling in the wind, and the snow seemed to rush at his face. Rob was well ahead, glancing back over his shoulder from time to time to make sure Bran and the others were following. He snapped the reins again. Smooth as silk, Dancer slid into a gallop. The distance closed. By the time he caught Rob, on the edge of the Wolf's Wood, 2 miles beyond the winter town, they had left the others well behind. "I can ride!" Bran shouted, grinning. It felt almost as good as flying.
"I'd race you, but I fear you'd win."
Rob's tone was light and joking, yet Bran could tell that something was troubling his brother underneath the smile.
"I don't want to race." Bran looked around for the dire wolves. Both had vanished into the wood. "Did you hear Summer howling last night?"
"Grey Wind was restless too," Rob said. His auburn hair had grown shaggy and unkempt, and a reddish stubble covered his jaw, making him look older than his 15 years.
"Sometimes I think they know things, sense things," Rob sighed.
"I never know how much to tell you, Bran. I wish you were older."
"I'm 8 now," Bran said. 8 isn't so much younger than 15, and I'm the heir to Winterfell after you."
"So you are," Rob sounded sad, and even a little scared.
"Bran, I need to tell you something. There was a bird last night, from King's Landing. Maester Lewin woke me."
Bran felt a sudden dread.
"Dark wings, dark words," old Nan always said. And of late, the messenger ravens had been proving the truth of that proverb. When Rob wrote to the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, the bird that came back brought word that Uncle Benjen was still missing. Then a message had arrived from the Eyrie for Mother, but that had not been good news either. She did not say when she meant to return, only that she had taken the imp as prisoner. Bran had sort of liked the little man, yet the name Lannister sent cold fingers creeping up his spine.
There was something about the Lannisters, something he ought to remember, but when he tried to think what, he felt dizzy, and his stomach clenched hard as a stone.
Rob spent most of that day locked behind closed doors with Maester Lewin, Theon Greyjoy, and Halas Mollen. Afterwards, riders were sent out on fast horses, carrying Rob's commands throughout the north. Bran heard talk of Moat Cailin, the ancient stronghold the first men had built at the top of the neck. No one ever told him what was happening, yet he knew it was not good. And now another raven, another message. Bran clung to hope. Was a bird for Mother? Is she coming home? The message was from Allen in King's Landing. Jorah Cassel is dead, and Will, and Heward as well. Murdered by the Kingslayer. Rob lifted his face to the snow, and the flakes melted on his cheeks. May the gods give them rest. Bran did not know what to say. He felt as if he'd been punched. Jory had been captain of the household guard at Winterfell since before Bran was born.
They killed Jory?
He remembered all the times Jory had chased him over the roofs. He could picture him striding across the yard in mail and plate, or sitting at his accustomed place on the bench in the great hall, joking as he ate.
Why would anyone kill Jory?
Rob shook his head numbly, the pain plain in his eyes.
I don't know, and,
Bran, that's not the worst of it. Father was caught beneath a falling horse in the fight. Allen says his leg was shattered, and Maester Pycelle has given him the milk of the poppy, but they aren't sure when he... The sound of hoofbeats made him glance down the road to where Theon and the others were coming up.
When he will wake, Rob finished.
He laid his hand on the pommel of his sword then, and he went on in the solemn voice of Rob the Lord.
Bran, I promise you, whatever may happen, I will not let this be forgotten.
Something in his tone made Bran feel even more fearful.
What will you do? He asked as Theon Greyjoy reined in beside them.
Theon thinks I should call the banners, Rob said.
Blood for blood.
For once Greyjoy did not smile. His lean, dark face had a hungry look to it, and black hair fell down across his eyes. "Only the Lord can call the banners," Bran said, as the snow drifted down on them. "If your father dies," Theon said, "Rob will be Lord of Winterfell."
"He won't die!" Bran screamed at him.
Rob took his hand. "He won't die, not father," he said calmly. "Still, the honor of the North is in my hands now. When our Lord Father took his leave of us, he told me to be strong for you and for Rickon. I'm almost a man grown, Bran."
Bran shivered.
"I wish Mother was back," he said miserably. He looked round for Maester Lewin. His donkey was visible in the far distance, trotting over a rise. "Does Maester Lewin say to call the banners too?"
"The Maester is as timid as an old woman," said Theon.
"Father always listened to his counsel," Bran reminded his brother.
"Mother too."
"I listened to him," Rob said. "I listened to everyone." The joy Bran had felt at the ride was gone, melted away like the snowflakes on his face. Not so long ago, the thought of Rob calling the banners and riding off to war would have filled him with excitement, but now he felt only dread.